This is Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zinden for Jane Lindholm. Among the myriad of changes in how health care is delivered and paid for is a change in who is providing it. The Norman Rockwell image of the country doctor who makes house calls is clearly a thing of the past. But that doctor's business model still persists in some ways in the person of the physician in private practice. Increasingly, though, doctors are salaried employees of hospitals or health centers. It's a trend we're seeing across the nation and in Vermont, and the result is fewer and fewer independent doctors. Today, we'll talk about the trend, why it's happening, whether it matters to doctors and patients, and how it fits into the larger changes in the healthcare world. So here's the question for you. Is your doctor in private practice? Or is he or she part of a hospital system? Do you know? Does it make a difference to you as a patient? And if you're a physician, what do you see as the difference? What do private practice doctors bring to healthcare that we lose without them? We'd like to hear from you at 1-800-639-2211, or you can email us at vermontedition@vpr.net or post your comments at the Vermont Edition webpage or our Facebook page. Joining us today for the discussion is Dr. Paul Rice, a family medicine doctor and partner at Evergreen Family Health in Williston, and he's also chief medical officer at Health First, Vermont's independent practice association. Dr. Rice, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me to talk about this very timely topic.
Well, I thought we'd just start with something very basic because we've been using the word independent doctor. Just clarify for us who we're talking about when we talk about independent doctors and who are the other doctors.
Well, we're talking about physicians who own their practices and essentially are making the decisions about how healthcare is delivered at their office site. These are both primary care docs as well as independent specialty physicians. These folks don't earn a salary from a larger healthcare organization. They watch the overhead. They have business meetings with their management staff and their partners in practice, if they have partners, that is. And they are responsible for their patients without having to be sort of accountable to a larger organization whose salaries and reviews them.
And are there many practicing in Vermont at this point? What trends are you seeing?
Similar to the rest of the country, we've seen a substantial decline in those in independent practice. And there's various reasons for that. And I know we'll get into that a little bit. But the main reason is not because these are bad doctors with not enough patients. It's not because these physicians are terrible at running their medical practices. It has to do with the economics of running a small practice and not having the ability to work with how much payers are paying on behalf of the patients that they see, have very little clout, if you would, or a bargaining ability to have appropriate increases in rates from the various payers who pay for healthcare on behalf of patients.
Let's talk about the economics and you know, specifically what disadvantages independent doctors face or challenges they face that perhaps doctors working as part of a hospital or healthcare center who are salaried don't face.
One of the things we've seen escalate in the last 5 or 10 years is the demands on physicians. There are now some excellent surveys and studies that show that physicians in practice and not just independent practice, but physicians in practice are getting burned out. And a lot of that has really very little to do with them providing medical care to their direct medical face-to-face care with their patients. It has everything to do with sort of what we call the hassle factors of medicine, the prior authorizations to get a test or a drug covered, the electronic medical record system, which requires lots of clicks and pushes. And we now see that it takes about 2 hours of documentation direct face-to-face with your computer rather than face-to-face with your patients. For every hour that you see a patient, it takes 2 hours to document all your work. Those sort of hassle factors are what is actually much more difficult oftentimes in independent practice because you're not able to afford the tremendous administrative and support staffs that it takes to do all that extra work.
Do most independent doctors, I mean, you said they not all of them work as part of group practices, but do most of them?
It's really variable. There are many independent solo practitioners out there still in some specialty practices and in primary care. Most practices are two, three docs. The largest independent practices in this state are really maybe five to seven at most, which is very much unlike a lot of other states where multi-specialty group practices are independent and can be supportive of one another.
You talk about the changes in record keeping, you know, electronic records, the you know, kind of bureaucratic side of being a doctor. And I'm sure there's an expense associated with that. But, you know, we heard from a number of independent physicians in advance of the program, and none of them mentioned that. They all mentioned pay parity. So let's get to that issue and specifically what they're talking about. What disadvantages do independent doctors face then when it comes to compensation?
Well, I alluded to that a little bit. When you have a situation in a state like this where there's very few payers, other states have situations where, although it's probably a lot more hassle, they may have 10 to 20 different commercial payers.
Insurance companies.
Insurance companies like Blue Cross, MVP, Cigna, United, those kind. In this state, we have one very, very dominant one that has a huge percentage of the market. And so physicians sort of have to take that or you'd lose half your patients. Because of the reliance on that and the inability to negotiate increases in rates each year with that particular payer and the others, you're not able to keep up with the overhead costs of electronic record systems, malpractice insurance, just the cost of your staff, and actually paying for health insurance for your staff.
And just so we understand this, and forgive me if I'm being too simplistic in this, just so people understand, it's not you who's setting the cost for a procedure. You've really got to go to an insurance company, assuming the person is insured, and most people are in some way, to be compensated. And it's that entity that is determining the cost, correct?
Yes, healthcare is very unique in that way. Some people would say, well, if you raise your rates, you get paid more. Well, it actually doesn't work that way in healthcare because 95% of your patients have an insurer who pays you. It does. So the rates that a hospital charges or that we charge in our office really have very little to do with it actually gets paid on your behalf.
And what a hospital might make or, you know, for a procedure offered by one of the physicians in their employ can be very different from what an independent physician might receive for the same procedure.
Well, that's very much true. Several of our physicians testified in the legislature last year about this issue, and many of the legislators were incredulous and couldn't believe what we were telling them. The actual rates that are being paid, and we're talking about professional fees here for the physician services, not the facility fees that, for instance, a hospital gets paid to turn on the lights and provide the equipment. We're talking about the actual payment for the physician's services themselves is oftentimes 200 and 300 times, literally percent higher or 2 to 3 times as much in a hospital-employed practice as it is in an independent practice.
So can you just give us a for example?
To boil it down, the most simple example, and these aren't actual numbers, but if a patient comes to see me for a sore throat compared to seeing the hospital-employed practice down the road, same type practice, family medicine, same training, same equipment, same services. For a sore throat, there's a charge for the visit itself, for the strep test, and that's pretty much it. So in my office, I might get paid, let's say, $100 for the visit and $40 for the strep test. So that's $140. Down the road, and this is important, the patient with a deductible who hasn't met their deductible is going to pay $140 out of their pocket from their HSA, health savings account, or direct out of their pocket.
So this is where it's going to make a difference to the patient.
Huge difference. Because down the road, if they see a hospital-employed practice, that charge is going to be $200 for the visit and it's going to be $80 for the strep test. So they're going to pay $280, and that practice will receive $280 down the road, even though it's not part of the building of the hospital. It's a community practice with hospital-employed physicians.
And this is, you know, sort of employing a well-known negotiating technique, if you want to call it that. It's sort of the ability to bring to bear a lot of power if you're negotiating on behalf of a large entity, whether it's a hospital or a Walmart, to bring prices of a product or service down. So the hospitals, as I think you're arguing, have the leverage with an insurance company to
actually bring the prices up
in their case, right? But you're an association of independent doctors. Mm. You don't have some leverage of your own to negotiate a better fee for services.
That's an excellent question. We legally can't, because we're not under the same tax ID, and we're not considered one practice in that realm. Although we're you know, we work together with an accountable care organization. We work together with a common quality staff that helps our practices improve our quality metrics. But we can't negotiate with an insurer together. Or they consider it, even though all of us together would be a fraction of the size of some of the hospitals, it would be considered collusion to work with commercial payers.
So that's against the law, essentially.
And it essentially is against the law for us to do
and
that.
And it's not unique to Vermont.
No.
So when those how do you learn what you're going to get from an insurance company for a service? Is it something set on an annual basis and you're just informed of it, or is there some dialogue that occurs?
No, it's pretty much you assume that you're getting no raise every year unless they tell you you are. Now, some practices are able to, you know, tweak a little bit if they ask for a meeting and try to negotiate something from one of the payers. But it's usually extremely resource intensive, and you get very little out of it most of the time. Most payers have what they call a community fee schedule, and that's what you get. And if you don't want it, you're sort of out of luck. So there's really no negotiation that truly goes on. And a big part of the problem, of course, is that the payers are under budget pressures themselves to keep rates down. And, of course, when they're paying huge amounts to those that can dictate fees, there's very little left for those independent practices to be paid fairly each year.
Today on Vermont Edition, the role of independent doctors in Vermont healthcare system. We're talking, as we have the last few minutes, about the challenges they face when it comes to fees and whether, from a patient's perspective, it makes a difference to have a private practice doctor when increasingly physicians are employed by hospitals or healthcare centers. What's your opinion? Call us at 1-800-639-2211. You can post at the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or at the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We're talking with Dr. Paul Rice, himself an independent physician in family medicine and a partner at a Williston physicians group, and chief medical officer at Health First, which is the Vermont Independent Practice Association we talked about. Dr. Rice, here I mentioned that we've heard from a number of doctors. Here's a listener who calls herself the last dodo. I'm a primary care practitioner in a large private practice in Chittenden County. Pay parity is one of the many things that might, and she emphasizes might, ensure our survival. We have proven time and time again that we are lean and efficient and save the system and taxpayers' money. In addition, we have a dedication to our patients that can only come from living in the community with them and sharing our lives inside and outside of the office with them. What else do we have to do to have you hear us? She writes.
Mm. Well, her problem is she correctly identifies some of the real benefits that you asked about to independent practice. That's the ability to really get to know your patients and provide personal care. When a patient calls late in the day and needs something, you stay late and you take care of them. And if you're a specialist and a primary care doctor says they've got a difficult problem in your specialty, they'll often say, send them over. Whereas oftentimes elsewhere it might be send them to the emergency room and we'll get to them when we can. So that personal care, the ability to be flexible with schedules, the ability to be flexible with how you take care of patients is one of the real benefits of independence.
So to get back to that pay parity issue in what you were describing as, you know, hospitals getting sometimes two or three times more for a procedure than an independent physician might get, is it the case of the hospitals getting too much and the independent physicians getting too little? How do you find the true and fair cost of a procedure?
Well, you certainly have comparisons outside the state, and you have comparisons for what other commercial payers pay elsewhere. There was a bill passed last year in the legislature that asked the payers to come up with a plan towards pay parity and present it to the Green Mountain Care Board. The Green Mountain Care Board now has plans from Blue Cross and from MVP as to how they wish to approach that. Both of them submitted plans, but they are tremendously different from each other. MVP, which has a significant presence out of state and knows what costs of care are elsewhere, has said the costs of care here are much too high. Please help us bring them down. We need help with that. You know, Blue Cross, on the other hand, submitted a plan that said, well, we will reduce essentially, I'm going to sort of simplify it, but it will reduce the pay to the hospital employed docs, but we'll move those payments to facility fees instead and essentially be neutral. Which unfortunately doesn't address the real problem, which is most people would say those payments are higher than what they should be if you're going to stimulate a hospital to be as efficient and as lean as possible in delivering the services.
And if we're going to agree that independent physicians aren't getting enough for the procedures, then aren't we increasing the cost of healthcare overall and contributing to the problem that we all acknowledge we have?
Right. Well, the idea is to increase the pay to primary care physicians and specialists in independent practice some. We're not talking about meeting in the middle, because there's quite a bit fewer independent practitioners than there are hospital employed now, mm-hmm. Especially here in Chittenden County. So you really only have to increase the pay for those to keep up with inflation and to keep up with lack of past increases, 20-25%. And what would that take out of the hospital budget? Very, very small amount, maybe 5%, 10% of what they're paying for professional fees now. And you could make a much more fair system without even making them the same. So so that's what's necessary to keep independent practices delivering care. And they provide care, and it's been proven, at lower costs and much more efficiently with less overhead than hospital-employed practices. And so if we're going to keep the cost of care down, we need to support them, because they're one of our best methods to do that.
Let's take a call from David in South Burlington for Dr. Paul Rice. Hi, David. Go ahead.
This is David Weisgold. I am a small practice ophthalmologist, eye specialist in South Burlington. Just calling to thank Vermont Edition for addressing this issue, and to thank Dr. Rice for bringing some specifics to the fore. I understand that it may be difficult for many folks who don't deal with medical economics on an everyday basis in their own lives to think of real-world examples. I think Dr. Rice provided some fantastic examples for us. I would just like to provide one small vignette from my own practice's life. When we are small practices and we have employees, we often wear two hats with insurance companies. One hat is as a provider, as it were. You know, we are providing care for insurance companies' patient members, and we are paid by the insurance companies to provide that care. And the other hat we wear is as employers who have to purchase health benefits for our own employees. In my small medical practice, during one recent 7-year period of time, the amount of premium increases that were enacted by the largest the insurance company, the commercial insurance company with the largest share of the market in our area, increased over a seven-year period by 100% per capita for my employees' health insurance benefits. During that same seven-year period of time, the pay increase to us to provide care went up by less than 1%. So there is a huge gulf between the spiraling, increasing costs of the care and the near total lockdown on pay for that care in those practices where the care, has, as Dr. Rice has stated, has been shown to be much, much less expensive. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, David. Appreciate the call. And if you care to call our program today, our number is 1-800-639-2211 as we talk about the role of independent private practice doctors in Vermont, some of the challenges they face. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zind. This is Vermont Edition. We can be forgiven for being confused about what all the changes in health care that are taking place or being discussed mean to us, but one result of those changes is a declining number of doctors in business for themselves. The independent physicians say the system presents some real obstacles to their ability to remain in private practice. So today we're asking what those obstacles are and why it matters to us as patients. We hope you'll weigh in as well. Are the trends in health care that we've been talking about improving patient outcomes and controlling costs, or are there better solutions? Is it important to have independent doctors, or does the system work just as well with doctors who work for hospitals? 1-800-639-2211 is our number. You can also post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page, and we're having our discussion with Dr. Paul Rice, a family medicine doctor in Williston and chief medical officer at Health First, Vermont's independent practice association. I have to ask Dr. Rice, we've talked about, and we heard our previous caller, who's a physician, talk about the increase in healthcare and premiums for his employees, and compared to, you know, minuscule increases for what he's receiving for services. What's the incentive to remain an independent physician as opposed to going into the employ of a hospital or healthcare center?
Right. That's a great question. And I've been in both. I was an employee of the hospital system out of practice some many years ago, and also was an employee of a community health plan, which was a HMO here in the 90s. And then went into private practice. And I can tell you I've been in those different settings. And the greatest thing about private practice is you can be much more nimble, much more flexible. In the way you provide your care. For instance, if you have a form that you want filled out by your patients, it doesn't have to go to a forms committee and be checked by lawyers before you have patients fill it out. You can change the way you order tests. You can change the lab you use to get those tests at. You can make a lot of changes that benefit your patients immediately. You might want to decide that there's a better way to help diabetic patients improve their diabetic control, and whether it's with certain medications or a certain program. And you can pretty much put that into into action right away. It doesn't have to go through all sorts of different committees and administrators to change the way you see patients.
We had I think the email we read earlier kind of alluded to a different sort of care, perhaps a more ability to take time with patients than physicians in the employ of hospitals might have. But at the same time, I mean, aren't you just as isn't it just as necessary for you to see as many patients as possible as an independent physician in order to maintain your practice, to make it sustainable? So is there really that much difference?
Well, that's the real challenge now. Although that pressure is on employed practitioners as well. Most of them are under productivity sort of measures for some of their pay or their bonuses. So they're being sort of pushed along to see more and do more to have more income flow based on on who they see. But an independent practitioner can make those decisions about how many patients they want to see and for how long they want to see them. But their systems can also be much more efficient in taking care of those patients. You don't have as much staff sometimes, and that can be a hindrance, but it can also cause less hassle for the patients in being seen. We can get patients in that same day most days by adding on, by staying late, by using our nurse practitioners and PAs to assist us with care, and in a lot of ways provide that more personal care that you can in an office that you control and that you run, and patients know who they're going to see.
Dr. Rice, here's an email we got from Rick, who writes from a patient's perspective. I was comparing prices for a potential shoulder surgery around the time that my orthopedist was going from an independent to a hospital-owned practice. It took some time for our insurer to finally provide me the information, but after several calls, I was told that if the surgery was done prior to April 1st, the date when the practice would officially join the local hospital, the surgeon's fee would be $1,350. However, if the surgery was after April 1st, because the surgeon would now be a hospital employee, the fee would jump to $3,140. Same building, same OR, same post-op care. I think this adequately demonstrates the danger to our healthcare system. Affordability as more and more independent practices are forced to either close their doors completely or become hospital-owned. So that's Rick's comment,
yeah.
Dr. Rice.
We should be able to move to a system where people are paid more for higher quality, for example, and they should be paid more for higher quality, better service, that kind of thing. But our current system is not that way.
Are you seeing physicians, we've talked about a decline in the number of independent physicians, but I wonder if you're also seeing some who are leaving the employ of hospitals or healthcare centers to become independent physicians.
Well, I can tell you there are a number of independent, previously independent physicians who very, very much wanted to stay independent, but were forced out of independent practice by the economics in this state, which seem to be much more acute than they are in some other communities in some other states. But there are physicians employed by hospital now. I know, I've talked with them, who very much want to go out of and be an independent practice, but it's very risky because of those current economics we've talked about.
And you talked about other places where there might be 10 or 12 insurance providers. Do you think it would be a better situation for independent doctors if there were more insurance providers?
Well, if you have the ability to drop an insurance provider who is seriously underpaying you for the value of your services, and then you have a much more negotiating ability for that insurer to keep you in the network and pay you fairly to do that.
Let's talk to Jerry, who's calling us from South Burlington. Hi, Jerry. Go ahead.
Hi. So I'm going to follow up on a point you just made previously between the charges between an independent practice and the University of Vermont Medical Center. I had a hand surgeon, hand problem looked at by an independent surgeon in South Burlington in 2015. He billed the insurance company $126 for the visit, and after my $20 copay, the insurance company Blue Cross Blue Shield paid him $63.51. I then wanted a second opinion, so I saw a physician assistant who specialized in hand problems in the University of Vermont Medical Center. She billed at $292, and after my $20 copay, the insurance company paid her $228.83. So for the visit itself, going to see a University of Vermont Medical Center personnel was 230% more, and the payment from Blue Cross Blue Shield to the University of Vermont Medical Center was 360% higher to a physician assistant versus to what they paid the hand surgeon. Of interest is the fact that that surgical practice now has been bought out by the University of Vermont Medical Center, and if they now went to them, the prices would be the same as what the physician assistant received.
And I'm sorry, Jerry, was your copay the same? I missed that.
Copay was the same, $20 for each one. So again, the difference in the billing was 230% higher by the PA as opposed to the hand surgeon, and the reimbursement from Blue Cross Blue Shield was 360% higher to the PA versus the hand surgeon. And that practice has now been bought by the University of Vermont Medical Center.
Thanks, Jerry. Dr. Rice?
Yeah, so you were fortunate just to have a copay. more and more, especially on these exchange plans that many of us in small business have to be on and have for our employees, there's a big deductible before you get even to the just paying a copay. Some folks, including my own plan that I have through my practice, has a $5,000 deductible. So I would have paid the whole bill and that difference of 300% rather than just a copay if that was me seeking care or any of my employees.
We haven't talked about Medicare or Medicaid, and really we're talking, I don't know what significant portion of your patients you're seeing who are covered under Medicare or Medicaid.
Yeah, so most of our independent practices in our association see Medicare and Medicaid patients. Some are questioning their ability to continue to do that or to continue to take especially new Medicare or Medicaid patients because you're essentially agreeing to accept a fee that's well below the cost of being able to provide those services oftentimes. And so one example of how that problem really played out last year and why we lost a number of independent practices, especially up in Franklin County, providing pediatric care, was the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, allowed the Medicare fees to be Medicaid fees to be paid at Medicare rates, which are typically higher, for 2 years. And the feds helped cover that. And so that came with expansion and expected expansion of Medicaid coverages by the states so that more folks could be covered under Medicaid. And that was done for 2 years. But January of this past year, that was ended. Now, a lot of states, the idea was the states would pick that up and continue that so that the access to primary care, especially under Medicaid, would continue. But this state did not do that. And so we were left basically with a 22% pay cut for those Medicaid patients January of this past year. And with that huge hit, we saw practices have to close because it wasn't sustainable.
All doctors, whether they're hospital employed or independent, are seeing those changes, correct?
Those particular changes in primary care were not experienced by the federally qualified health centers, which are sort of those health centers that are out there as the sort of last resort, if you would, to take care of folks who are uninsured and underinsured, and that we have many of them in the state, and they do tremendous work, but they're paid on a different. Under a different program that supports their ability to take those patients. But hospital-employed physicians in primary care took that hit as well. But they have the ability to increase their fees every year from the commercial payers, whereas you don't have that ability to make that up in independent practice. And one outcome we saw in that fee cut was we've actually seen a 20% increase in ER utilization over the past year through our statewide blueprint program, who tracks that kind of data. And that 20% increase in ER utilization must be to some extent due to a lack of access. So now we have fewer ability for independent practitioners and private practice, especially around the state, to get those patients in same day and see them after hours or during hours. So they're having to go to the emergency room more often.
Let's check in with Thomas, who's calling us from the Northeast Kingdom. Hi, Thomas.
Thanks so much for taking my call. And your topic about accessibility comes right at the time where I'm going to say that being up in the Northeast Kingdom, sometimes accessibility to affordable health care, such as during the week calling your doctor, going into the doctor's office, as opposed to going to the emergency room. It's not financially feasible for the patient, out-of-pocket expenses, or the insurance company. So the problem lies is you have a hospital, they have an emergency room, it's the weekend, there's no walk-in clinic available, it doesn't exist. For whatever reason, probably because they want to pay you, they want to charge you full price. So the problem is, I think if we could make the accessibility a lot easier, as opposed to people rushing to the emergency room when you're truly not in an emergency situation. And sometimes you call the doctor says, I can't see you, go to the emergency room.
Thomas, thanks. Our doctors, is accessibility an increasing issue as independent number of independent doctors declines?
Accessibility becomes much more of an issue, and there's a number of reasons for it. we alluded to the fact that there's a lot more of those hassle factors. Well, that takes physicians' time away from taking care of patients. So the more demands you put on physicians' practice to report, to do quality med, to do quality improvement, to have meetings, to go to statewide learning collaboratives and the various other things that we're being asked to do, that takes time away from actually seeing patients. So patients have less access to that physician and to primary care as a whole. Also, you would think it would be in the insurance company's best interest to make sure they have a primary care workforce that's strong and accessible. We've talked about it. We've talked about the importance of primary care at length, but we've actually done very little to nothing to improve the accessibility and the numbers of primary care practices accepting new patients and able to get patients in that same day. It's very costly to get patients in same day because you have to leave time and personnel to take care of those things that come up. And so you risk not seeing other patients during that time. It's extremely costly, but unless we support that, people are going to need to go to the emergency room instead, unfortunately.
Here's another comment, Dr. Rice, from a listener with the screen name, a small practice owner. I own a small primary care office in a rural section of Chittenden County. Offices such as mine play a critical role in our country's health care by helping to lower costs and reducing wait times. The very laws that were designed to prevent monopolies in health care are seemingly promoting just that, and larger hospitals are becoming less accountable in driving down the cost of health care because many view them as too big to fail. Just one final question. I mean, we've talked so much about parity. Is there anything on the horizon that gives you optimism that you're going to make some progress on that?
Well, you know, a lot has been put on the Green Mountain Care Board to help control costs. They I think, have been frustrated with their inability to do it, despite really working hard at it. And you know, one of the things that they could do and have the ability to do is be more tough with the payers and more tough with some of the hospitals who. Could probably work more efficiently and run less surplus each year and be able to spread that extra savings into accessibility for primary care and for community-based practices.
Paul Rice, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And we're going to switch subjects entirely in just a minute. The annual migration of shorebirds offers a brief opportunity to see a variety of species as they wing their way south. We'll hear about those birds, which ones are passing through, and where to see them next on Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zind. It won't be long before we'll be seeing the chevrons of Canada geese migrating southward or rushing to the Dead Creek Wildlife Management Area in Addison to catch a glimpse of the snow geese stopping off there. But right now, there's a great reason for serious birders and casual bird buffs to get the field glasses out because shorebirds are making their annual migration south. And joining us now to tell us what to see and where is John Buck, a non-game bird biologist with Vermont Fish and Wildlife. John, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Steve. It's great to be here.
Well, for those of us who aren't what we would call serious birders, who are we talking about when we say shorebirds?
Well, these are all the birds that are commonly associated with coastal areas that if you were to go to Cape Cod or any beach area along the ocean, you might see these birds at various times during the summer or during migration. But, you know, we don't have that opportunity in Vermont, but maybe only once or twice a year when, as they make their migratory routes, they'll stop over in landlocked states like ours just to get a quick bite to eat, to fuel up and get ready for the long journey south.
What particular species are we talking about, John?
Well, it's a wide variety, and there's some really interesting species. These are species that, you know, nest in the Canadian prairies and even as far north as the Northwest Territories, like the ruddy turnstone, the lee sandpiper, black-bellied plovers, solitary sandpipers, American golden plovers, short-billed dowitchers. There's a very, very long list, and they're a very challenging group of birds to identify because they all have some very similar characteristics, but they're all very unique as well.
And they're all coming from shores somewhere in Canada, obviously not Cape Cod, or they're going in the wrong direction, I would assume.
Right, right. No, on the lake shores of the giant lakes you find in northern Canada, yeah, or Hudson Bay, James Bay, any of the coastal areas. You know, Canada has some of the largest coastal areas on the planet, and they host these unique birds each summer for their very, very short nesting season.
And where are they heading to for the winter?
Largely, they're headed towards the Caribbean and coastal South America. So it's a long, long journey, almost circumpolar in some cases for some of these birds. So being able to stop over and get a very nutritious fuel up of invertebrates and other insects that they might be feeding on is, you know, very, very important for them.
So assuming they live up to their name as shorebirds, do we have to go to a shore somewhere in Vermont to see them?
Typically you do, and we're very fortunate to have, you know, Lake Champlain is probably the most prominent shoreline that we have. And, you know, although the drought conditions we have right now have been not good for most every other living thing that we're concerned with here, the exposed shoreline, the mud flats and the gravel bars that you find on the lake and in our rivers right now provide excellent feeding habitat for these shorebirds. So those are some of the locations that birders should go to hope to find these birds.
Any particular spots along Lake Champlain that you might recommend?
Certainly. You mentioned Dead Creek Wildlife Management Area. That's probably one of the premier areas for shorebirds and all birds to stop over during migration. That's in Addison. And the related creeks with Addison, so Dead Creek, Whitney Creek, Hospital Creek, Otter Creek, the mouths of our major rivers like the Winooski, the Lamoille, mm-hmm, and the Missisquoi offer some great shorebird viewing opportunities. The Missisquoi National Wildlife Refuge is another great spot up in Swanton, so I'd highly recommend going up there. They have a wonderful visitor center and great staff that work there and be of great help to casual birders and the experts alike.
What's the kind of peak period of time when we're most likely to see shorebirds?
Well, I think we're coming into it right now as I monitor sightings from around the state from all of the birders who you know essentially record their sightings on Vermont eBird. We're seeing an uptick in the number of these species now. So I would take advantage of this fabulous weather that we're having and grab a pair of binoculars and a camera, mm-hmm, and something to eat, too, because you have to be very patient, and mostly you have to be very lucky. These birds come in, they stay maybe for a day, maybe for a few hours, maybe a couple days if you're lucky, but they don't stay long because they have such a long journey ahead of them. They just stop in, something to eat, and then they're off again.
John, I'm going to assume that maybe you've gone out looking for shorebirds. If that's the case, any particular bird you've spotted or experienced stick in your mind?
Well, I've seen some semi-palmated sandpipers on their way back. This was back in late August, and I wasn't anywhere near a shore when I saw them. I was actually in the woods in a clearing that had been made as part of a log landing on one of our property's wildlife management areas. And there was a depression in the ground. It was full of water, believe it or not. And there was a small group of semi-palmated sandpipers feeding voraciously on the invertebrates that were in that water spot. And it was just pure luck. I wasn't expecting to see them, but there they were. And I found that to be really, really striking. It was really just a wonderful opportunity.
Do the shorebirds like geese travel in larger flocks, or are we likely to see them in small groups or individually?
They'll be in, I would say, small flocks or individuals, you know, one or two birds here and there. Sometimes you might see a dozen or two dozen. And they could be mixed with other species, too, which is kind of deceiving. So you really have to pay attention to the different profiles, the flight patterns. You might get a good look at some coloration differences, mm-hmm, you know, to be able to discern different, yeah, species. So you really have to be kind of on the watch. Like I say, dress for the weather and make yourself as comfortable as possible because you may stay for a while before you really catch a good glimpse. But, you know, it's just such a thrill to see these unique birds that have traveled so far and have so far to go for them to stop over and give us a glimpse.
John Buck, thanks for taking the time to tell us about the shorebirds.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much, Steve.
John is a non-game bird biologist with Vermont Fish and Wildlife. Well, space is the final frontier, and it's been getting a ton of publicity lately. From a new planet to a distant signal to living in a Mars simulator, space has been top of the mind. And tomorrow, we speak to a couple of Vermonters who have had a front row seat to all the exciting astral happenings. If you have questions or comments about anything spatial, Vermont Edition at vpr.net is the email address. And, of course, listen tomorrow at noon. Our program is produced by Rick Sangeri, Sam Gale-Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Steve Zind. Thanks a lot for listening.